Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or like me on Facebook at Brian Lehrer WNYC. And as troops are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, here's a problem you probably don't think about, but you know who does? Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, as he said last year.
How can the Army break up the institutional concrete, its bureaucratic rigidity in its assignments and promotion processes, in order to retain, challenge, and inspire its best, brightest, and most battle-tested young officers to lead the service in the future? After the major Afghan troop deployments end in 2014, how do we keep you and those 5 or 10 years older than you in our Army?
Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, actually that was from 2011, and also thinking about that challenge is my next guest, Tim Kaine, author of Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and Why It's Time for a Revolution. He's also the chief economist at the conservative D.C. think tank, the Hudson Institute. Welcome to WNYC. Tim, thanks for coming on.
Brian, thank you.
We heard Gates talk about institutional concrete and bureaucratic rigidity. So for those listeners who aren't familiar with the system of promotions or careers in the military, can you explain what happens basically?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm a graduate of the Air Force Academy, so I saw this thing, Bleeding Talent, in many dimensions, both where you see very talented young officers leave before they ideally would have, but you also see internal bleeding, where you've got great senior leaders and they're just matched with the wrong jobs. Because in the military, it's not that you earn a qualification as a pilot. That's what you are. You're a pilot. You don't have options to just, you know, change jobs without permission from on high. So the notion that we've got this command and control, almost Soviet-style market, instead of a free market for labor, is really frustrating, and that's what drives away a lot of the talented guys. They love the service, and actually a lot of them, you know, don't mind the combat. They love serving their country and fighting bad guys, but the bureaucracy drives people out.
But what would a free market for labor, as you put it, look like in the U.S. military? Because a lot of people probably think that the military works so well, really it's one of the few respected institutions in the United States right now,
true,
according to the polls, that one of the reasons that it does actually work so well is because it is command and control.
Yeah, that's an easy mistake to make, and the high respect we have for the military in a bit shields it from the necessary criticism. So I took a survey of West Point graduates, and you know, 55% of the people who have left say the system needs to be radically reformed. 55% of the people on active duty also say the personnel system needs to be radically reformed, and they're calling for more recognition of meritocracy and less seniority. So, you know, how it would work is basically how it works in any large corporation or even in any small economy. We're all familiar with applying for jobs and using resumes. But the neat thing, Brian, is this issue of bleeding talent's not new. President Harry Truman worried about it. President Eisenhower worried about it. And in fact, the military did reform itself when it ended the draft. And if you think about that, conscripting people to go fight in Vietnam was very controversial. And yet the generals in the Pentagon said, well, gee, we couldn't have a free market system to recruit our talent. In fact, we all know, yes, you can. Using an all-volunteer force, we have an even more talented enlisted corps and officer corps. So, you know, it's not that hard to prove the point that freedom actually does work.
Listeners, anybody out there right now who might want to chime in on this, if you served and made the decision not to stay in the military, what tipped the scales for you? Were you wary of what Tim Kaine is describing? Did you feel like your talent wouldn't be recognized because it was more of a seniority system? 212-433-WNYC or anyone in active duty right now listening in, if you're approaching the 20-year retirement mark maybe and mulling a career decision, or even just if your initial enlistment is up and you're deciding what to do, what are the factors? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692 for Tim Kaine, author of the book Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and why it's time for a revolution. And to build on what you were just saying a minute ago, you proposed something called the total volunteer force. What would that be?
So it's basically the next step. We went from conscription to an all-volunteer force, or AVF. I really try to not just talk in conceptual terms, but lay out what are some of the things that you would do with a total volunteer force. Meaning, Brian, how it works now is you are a volunteer when you join the military, Marines, Army, Navy, and God bless the men and women who do that. I do think they're heroes, but they're really only volunteers for that first day. By day two, they're being told where to go, what to do, what to wear, when to show up. And so there's the total volunteer force, if it could boil down to one thing, it would give commanders of various military units, the captain of an aircraft carrier, they would have singular hiring authority.
Hmm.
It wouldn't be a gigantic bureaucracy that matches supply and demand. It would be essentially a market, and that means commanders do the hiring.
Wow. By the way, on the term volunteer force, I generally personally don't like it, and I'm curious to get your take on it. Because we don't really have a volunteer force like a volunteer fire department. We have a professional military. We have one that pays a wage, that offers the GI Bill, that recruits competitively through advertising, and, you know, offers an experience that people might like as one of its selling points, or a better economic opportunity than, you know, some recruits might get elsewhere. So would it not be more accurate to call it a professional military than a volunteer one?
I actually, you know, I agree with you on that. And in fact, there's a history of that language, professional military versus what some people want. I think it's bogus language, but they call it, we need a citizen army, meaning they wanted to conscript people and draft people. I'd rather have a professional military where people can serve for 20 years instead of just two at a time. Ends up, you get better soldiers that way. You have fewer fatalities. So, you know, I agree with you, but I do think that means you have to recognize the freedom of the individual to make that commitment.
Edward in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good, Ed.
Hey.
Yeah.
I agree with you to a certain extent as far as, because I was in the military, I was in for 4 years, and I didn't reenlist. One of the main points why I didn't reenlist was because of the lack of diversification and the ability to move around laterally. You can only, with your MOS, which is military occupational skill set, you can only move into certain departments based on the command and based on what's available. So I agree with you there. There is a stifling effect to that. But where I disagree with you is it's a part of the function of the military. You got to remember, it's a fighting force, and you're asking people to die. So there is going to be a certain amount of restriction, a certain amount of control, a certain amount of bending of the spirit, for want of a better word. So you're not going to get that as you would in a civilian field. It's really got to, if you're really going to stay in the military, because I still have friends that are in the military, and it changes from an actual job to a vocation. It's like akin to the priesthood or something, not to be facetious, mm-hmm. but it becomes your vocation, and that's when you get a good soldier. But they should lighten up on as far as job function, and because talents do get wasted, and people that I have known in the military and that still are there are doing things that they don't really love or had to learn to love, and their skills and their true talents are being focused somewhere else, that if it was allowed to be focused in their true ability set, it would improve the military much greatly, make it more efficient.
Tim Kaine?
Yeah, boy, I want Edward to stay on the show and answer the rest of the questions because he really gets it. And that notion of the MOS becoming, you know, a bit of a cage for people, it's ridiculous. If you've got a commander that wanted to hire Edward, but he wasn't made, I don't know what Edward did. Let's say he was infantry and an artillery commander said, I'd really love to have this soldier with me. Well, he couldn't do it without permission from some bureaucracy. Most chances are it's going to get disapproved. So he's right, that notion of bleeding talent internally, where guys are locked into careers, they end up being stuck in the slots. We've got one story we talk about in the book of a guy named Dick Hewitt, who was, you know, one of the top graduates of his class at West Point, was promoted 1 year faster than other people, so he was up with the colonels as a major, and yet he turned down one assignment that wasn't going to work for his pregnant wife, and he got blacklisted by the Army. Now, he stayed in 20 years, but he was never given command, and it's tragedies like that really aren't necessary.
Mary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm a mother of a military soldier and his wife. She left when she did her 4 years and got out. My son stayed in for 10, was going to be at 20 years, but after 10 years, had left the service because of that reason. You're stuck in a rut, and there's no advancement, and for one decision or another, you're held in that place. And like you said, the MOS, you really are stuck in that cage. And now he's in the private sector and doing so much better and so much happier. And I'm, of course, happier because I don't have the fear of him going over a seas again after four tours.
Sure. Do you think, though, that skills-wise, the military could have retained him if they had the entrepreneurial flexibility that our guest is talking about?
That's right, that if they were a little bit more flexible, if they could cross over into other areas and they're not stuck in their one position, it would be, they would be able to retain a lot more talented personnel. But they are leaving. There is a mass exodus. Even with the sign-up bonuses and staying in, and the career advancements that you think are there, once you get there, are readily not available. As you say, that you need permission, it has to be approved, it gets disapproved. So it is frustrating, especially when you do have a family and you're raising a family and there are some decisions you have to make, like the previous person just said. With you, you make that one decision and you do get blacklisted. That does, it is held against you.
Mary, thank you for your call and good luck to your son. What do the obstacles of bureaucracy that you're describing, Tim, mean for a pared-down military that is almost certainly coming in the post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan era, and for that matter, for the troops who are coming home from Afghanistan now, as we think about making room in the private sector for these men and women?
Well, Mary had a great point. I mean, leaving at a 10-year point in a military career is a really tough choice because you actually leave a lot of retirement money on the table. This is illegal in the private sector. In the private sector, you can't force someone to work for you 20 years before they're allowed any of their retirement money. That notion of a cliff is sort of against, somebody who's patriotic, wants to serve. We don't have the flexibility for them in our military. But you know what's silly,
Brian?
So
there's no sort of 401k of system?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, if you got out of the military at, say, year 19, you're on the hook for 12 more months. You can get your retirement. You leave too early, you get zero. And that's really shameful for people who've been fighting and sacrificing. No reason we need to do it that way. You could have a more market-oriented. Why do they do it that way? Because they're using coercion instead of positive incentives. But to your question, Brian, something I saw when we had a bit of a drawdown at the end of the Cold War, and we'll have it again, when the military doesn't know how to manage with positive incentives, what they do is they actually pay people to leave. So rather than have the moral courage to say, we've got an open market, 80% of you are going to get jobs, 20% of you won't. They don't want to distinguish who's more talented, less talented. So instead they say, here's a bonus for people who will quit. Now, I saw one of my best commanders take an early retirement, and it really was heartbreaking. It's one of the reasons that I was sort of discouraged, kind of opened my eyes to it's not just a crazy bureaucracy, and we deal with it. It's a crazy bureaucracy, and it's hurting national security. And that's what the West Point graduates in my survey said on active duty.
Before you go, are there lessons here for the civilian world, or are these issues you're raising only particular to the military?
I think it actually goes in reverse direction. The private sector has really, really evolved in how they treat labor. It's a lot better than we had, when there were union strikes and whatnot. Now you've got places like Silicon Valley that are really pioneering in how to create a smart retirement system, how to have good workplace benefits. The military attracts great talent, and it has world-class training and education. Everybody knows that. What they're lacking in is this flexibility in the personnel system. But I do think this drawdown is a chance that, and like you heard Secretary Gates said at the top of your show, Brian, there's a chance now to learn, and I think there'll be a need to learn when the military goes through this transition.
Hey, let me slip in one more caller because I think Josh is calling in to talk about how he got around this inflexible system. Josh?
Yeah, hi. I was an MP headquarters commander in the Army National Guard. And we were able to leverage civilian skills that our soldiers had in their, you know, their in their civilian life to use their skills within our unit. So, for instance, I had one soldier who, you know, was trained by the Army to be a fuel service operator of a fuel truck, but he happened to be a paramedic. So we were down a medic. So we used him as a medic, even though our MTO or our operational tables didn't require one. And we were able to do that quite often with a lot of different people because they had a civilian skill that was more necessary to our mission as a as an Army National Guard unit than what they had actually been trained for in, by the Army.
Did you have to break rules in order to use people like that?
No, I mean we didn't break rules per se. I mean, to the extent that if the unit were it had to be deployed, those people would be deployed under their occupational specialty. But you know, everybody who's been in the service knows that you wear a lot of hats, particularly officers and NCOs. And when you're in the field, you know, there's a whole variety of different skills that you need that aren't necessarily part of your structure or mm-hmm. part of your operational organization.
Josh, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And we're going to leave it on Josh's story, a good example of, I guess, an officer trying to work around some of the limitations that are described in Tim Kaine's book called Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and Why It's Time for a Revolution. Tim, interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, if the calendar was a New York City building, we would just pretend this year wasn't there and call it 2014. So we'll try to discover where the fear of the number 13 came from and how to survive this year if you suffer from triskaidekaphobia. Stay with us.